Okay, well, we might begin. Great to see you here this afternoon. Profuse apologies on behalf of the thus far wonderful uni room bookings program. If you're a member of the Golden Key Society, that sounds very intriguing. I'd like to have a chat with you afterwards. But great to see you here this afternoon. Thanks particularly if you're joining us for our second hour today. We had a really stimulating and quite personal talk in the past hour from Lee McMunn on why people suffer. And we're going to be looking today at a really intense question of when life ends and who determines that. We're going to be hearing from ethics lecturer Andrew Sloan about that in just a short while. My name's Hugh, if I haven't met you before. I'm a fourth year history student and the president of the EU, and it's my great pleasure particularly to welcome you if this is your first time with us at one of our This Is Life events over these 3 weeks. The Evangelical Union is a group of about 700 students on campus who exist to find out more about the God of this world and his son Jesus revealed in the Christian Bible. And it's great that you can join us today. If you'd like to come to some of our other events, we'd love to see you along tomorrow. From 12 till 2 in the New Law Lecture Theatre. We'll be talking all about sex for 2 hours. It's going to be great. One more sleep. Really looking at the question of whether we're made for sexual freedom. The Bible has a whole book all about sex. So we've got lots to say about that, and we'd love to see you there and love to hear your questions. On the topic of questions, if you have any questions during today's talk by Andrew, we will be having question time at the end. If you'd like to pop your hand up and ask those questions in question time, do feel free. Otherwise, if you'd like to text your questions into this number on the screen, we'll be answering those questions at the end of our talk today. Final thing is, you've received a little flyer on the way in. That's another great way to let us know you are here today and allow us to answer any questions you have. So if you're able to fill out your details on that and write down any questions you have about the EU, about This Is Life, or about the topic today, we'd love to hear from you. Please just pop those questions in the green buckets on your way out to afternoon tea and we'll get back to you very soon. We'll be having afternoon tea from 2 p.m. People have been baking. I had some of the cookies this morning. They're awesome. And feel free to pick up any resources. Pick up a Bible, pick up some more information about this particular topic. That's enough from me, though. I'd like to now introduce our speaker for today. His name is Dr. Andrew Sloan, and he's going to be speaking to us today about when life ends and who determines it. So, Andrew, great to have you here today.
Thank you.
Andrew, you're a lecturer in ethics, amongst other things, at Morling College.
Yeah.
What's your sort of background leading into looking at ethics?
My initial training was in medicine. I did that at the proper university over in Kensington.
It's Kensington what? Community College. Isn't it?
That was many, many years ago. And having done that, then moved from medicine into Christian ministry in churches, and before doing further training in particularly Old Testament and philosophy, as well as ethics.
Yeah, great. And today, particularly looking at when life ends and who determines it.
Yeah.
If people wanted to take a next step to find out more, particular things they could do to answer more questions about that?
Sure, there's a wealth of material around, a number of books. I can talk about some of that later. I think the web has some, you know what the web's like, there's some good stuff and there's a whole lot of crap that you can find there. So just be a bit careful with what you find. But happy to chat with you afterwards about where you might go for further ideas.
Great, great. Well, thanks very much again for coming and speaking with us today, Andrew. Look forward to hearing what you have to say. Thanks.
You're welcome. I want to give just a few reflections, probably about 10, 12 minutes, that's all. Because I think it's very helpful to address the particular questions that you might have as you think about these issues, particularly issues at the beginning and the end of life. Now, Christianity, as I understand it at any rate, is a life-affirming faith, but it's a particular vision of life that we affirm, a vision of life in relationships, life with other people, life enmeshed in community, embodied in a good world, living in the presence of a good and life-giving God. Now, when I talk with people who wouldn't call themselves Christians, people of other faiths or none, lots of questions come up, many of which you've been looking at for those of you who've been here for some of the events over the last couple of weeks. Two of the most pressing relate to questions relating to the beginning and the end of life. Questions, obviously, about abortion and euthanasia. Difficult issues, I must confess, about which Christians are often seen as being kind of reactionary and restrictive and wanting to interfere with other people's lives, to interfere with women and their reproductive freedom in the case of abortion, and interfere with everybody's life in the case of decisions about the end of life. Now, I don't want to bore you, nor do I have the time to go through detailed... Well, I'll bore you anyway, but let's see how we go. I don't have time to deal with detailed arguments about when life begins and when life ends and arguments for and against euthanasia. What I want to do is offer some reflections on these questions from a particular Christian point of view. So let's begin at the beginning, dealing with issues of abortion. Now, as I'm sure you're aware of, if you've done any reading or thinking or talking about this at all, abortion is often presented as a matter of rights. For more conservative people, the right to life, the fetus right to life. Or, from the pro-choice views it's often called, a woman's right to determine what happens to her own body, to control her own reproductive capacities. Now, while I have sympathies with both these conflicting viewpoints, I'm not persuaded that either frames the question in quite the right way. First of all, because I'm not persuaded that we can be, dead certain about when human personal life begins. Not on the basis of Scripture. I don't think Scripture gives us a very clear answer to that question. I don't think philosophical reflection or science gives us a very clear answer to that question. And that's something that the pro-life view requires. If you're talking about the right to life of a human person, then you need to know that what we're dealing with is a human person. And I'm not sure that we can be crystal clear about that. On the other hand, I'm not persuaded that the pro-choice position is framed quite right either. While Christianity needs to lift its game on the valuing of women and of how we treat women, and we really need to lift our game, the underlying understanding of human existence in this pro-choice view seems to me to be misguided. I'll say a bit more about that in a moment. But furthermore, framing it in terms of rights and conflicting rights generally leaves us at an impasse, and there's no fruitful way forward. I think more fertile territory, sorry for that pun, I couldn't resist it. More helpful way of conducting the conversation can be found, I think, in this broad idea of a commitment to welcoming life. See, the God that I believe in is one who creates and sustains life and delights in it. As a Christian, as one who seeks to love and serve that God, I welcome human life for all its complexities, for all its inevitable tragedies, and I welcome it as a good gift of a good God. Abortion, as it seems to be practiced in places like Australia, at any rate, doesn't seem to fit with that kind of commitment. Now, as I said, I honestly don't know when human personal life begins. I don't know whether, say, a three-month-old fetus is a human person. Human tissue, yes, that's obvious. But a person? I don't know. And there are lots of arguments. I've come across many of them, and none of them seem to me to be fully persuasive. What does seem clear, though, is that our story as people, and this is a story of God's concern for us, of God's knowledge of us, of God's care for us, that story begins long before we are born. We are fearfully and wonderfully made. And so, while we can't be clear, I think, about a number of these important questions, a simple dismissing of any concern for the developing child and its evolving story seems to me a little casual and cavalier. What also seems clear, to me at any rate, is that in the normal course of events, a fetus is one essential stage in God's giving us the great gift and terrifying responsibility of welcoming another person into the world. Affirming life, it seems to me, welcoming it as a gift, fits poorly with aborting a child because it is unwanted or it complicates our lives or would mean major changes to our life plan. Now, please let me be clear about this. There are times when it seems to me abortion is a tragic necessity, when the mother's life is at risk or the fetus is going to inevitably die and rather nastily. There are other times when abortion is a tragic possibility, particularly most horribly when a woman falls pregnant as a result of sexual abuse or of rape. But they are tragic. They are tragic circumstances. It seems odd, though, to adopt abortion as a deliberate strategy, especially one which, it seems to me, often becomes a kind of de facto contraceptive of last and not even of last choice. Now, of course, let me be clear about this. We as Christians need to do more, a hell of a lot more, than just tut, tut and point the finger, which is often what we're known for, tragically. We're meant, rather, to create communities in which life is welcomed for all its messiness and in which we join with people in their struggle to embrace life rather than standing at a disapproving distance. But enough on that. I need to move on to the other end of life, from before the cradle, so to speak, to the last step before the grave. So what then of euthanasia? Well, let me first say that I understand the draw, the attraction of euthanasia. We, this generation, and you lot in particular, are most likely going to live longer than any previous human generation. Most of us currently alive will spend more time and money in healthcare in the last year of our lives than we spend in all the rest of our lives put together. So, scary thought. We face increasingly technologized deaths, in which in our dying we'll be surrounded by machines and technicians and the cold antisepsis of the hospital rather than the warm embrace of people we love. That's the kind of reality, quite frankly, that most of us face. And that same technology means that many of us may live longer than we might wish, and with pain and discomfort we don't want, and without the dignity that we do want. What, you might say, in the face of that, could be wrong with a dying person, knowing the inevitability of their deterioration, decay and death, choosing the manner and timing of their own death, choosing, say, a painless lethal injection administered by a competent person, which allows them to slip away quietly and with dignity in the presence of those that they love? Surely, we all feel the attraction of that. I certainly don't look forward to the possibility of the pain and indignity of a drawn-out death. The problem, however, is not so much with particular arguments for or against euthanasia, but with the visions of life and community that underpin them. It seems to me that embracing voluntary euthanasia entails a view of life and death and of health care which conflicts with a vision of the world that welcomes life and affirms it. See, it seems to me to require that we see ourselves as radically autonomous individuals, as people whose primary defining quality is freedom. Freedom from others and from dependence on them, and freedom to determine our own identity and destiny. The problem is that this conflicts not only with a Christian vision of welcoming life, but with the brute realities of human existence. For we are not atomistic individuals bouncing around in a self-determined world. We are, in fact, people in interdependent relationships, embedded in communities, depending on and providing care for each other. It's also important, I would suggest, to remember that euthanasia, as it is currently proposed and as it is practiced elsewhere, would be located within the healthcare system. Implementing it would result in a serious distortion of the nature and practice of healthcare. But to understand that claim, we need to step back a bit and think about what healthcare is, what it ought to be about, how it fits into our vision of a good society. Healthcare, I would suggest, is not primarily a matter of alleviating suffering. That may seem a bit odd. It's not primarily about curing disease or improving health. These are all desirable outcomes, of course, but they're not the primary focus of healthcare. The primary focus of healthcare lies in that second word. It's about caring for humans in their vulnerability and need. Illness, disease, injury, deformity, aging, and physical deterioration are all problems because they interfere with our plans and purposes, with our relationships, with our being in the world. They are healthcare's problems because they expose our vulnerability and weakness. Vulnerability and weakness that are, in fact, only ever just below the surface. And they also prompt that care for suffering, which is, I would suggest, one of the clearest expressions of the possibilities of true human community. Any humane society, it seems to me, must provide care for its vulnerable members, however that care is managed and implemented, at whatever level it's provided. Healthcare then fits into a vision of society in which we acknowledge our dependence on each other, from cradle to grave, but particularly in the cradle and at the edge of the grave. It seems, quite frankly, odd to me to consider euthanasia as an appropriate response to that vulnerability. Euthanasia seems to be aimed at the elimination of suffering at all costs, even at the expense of the existence of the sufferer. It seems to suggest that when cure is not possible, the only care that is left is to hasten our fellow human beings' inevitable death. A Christian vision of life and of the nature and role of healthcare in a vision of a good society sees a very clear and, I think, viable alternative, what could quite simply be called the appropriate care of dying people. Caring for people in their suffering and vulnerability, and even perhaps especially in their inevitable death, doesn't mean curative treatment at all costs, but nor does it mean abandoning them to death. It means that having recognised that some kinds of treatment are no longer appropriate, we turn from cure to care as our primary concern, which is where our concern always ought to be. It means ensuring that we control their pain and deal with their discomfort as best we can. It means granting them dignity, even in the indignities of their dying. And if you've never seen it, someone dying is never, ever, under any circumstances, dignified. It's a matter of doing what we can to dignify the indignities of their demise. Showing that now, even now as they approach death, we welcome their lives. And so even in the face of death, we can welcome life. We can welcome life by caring for those who are dying, showing that we value them and their contribution to our lives together, and that we, as we face our own inevitable death mirrored in theirs, that we share a commitment to life, indeed to their life, for all its weakness and fragility and pain and inevitable tragedy. Now, I'm sure that this doesn't even come close to answering all your questions. I wasn't attempting to. I hope it prompts, however, some useful thinking and fruitful conversations. Let me close with this last reflection. As a Christian, I don't flinch from death. I hate death. I hate what death does. I know its horrible reality, both personally and professionally. I hate the way it takes from our lived world people we love, silencing their voices, erasing their stories in all but memory. I hate death. But I don't flinch from it. But at rock bottom, as a Christian, I welcome life in all its complexity, even when it doesn't suit me, even perhaps especially when it's painful and tragic. I welcome life because of how such welcome fits in a Christian view of life in community and of what that means for our lives together in society. I don't know, perhaps you find this kind of picture of life together attractive or intriguing. Perhaps you just find it strange or puzzling. Let me encourage you to continue to think about what it means to welcome life, if that's a commitment you want to embrace. And if you do, let me encourage you to consider what that might mean, what it might mean in light of Christian faith to welcome life even when facing death. Thank you, and over to you.
Thanks very much, Andrew. Really sketched out for us some big sort of stakes in the ground from which to explore these big questions. We might take some questions from the floor first. If anyone's got any questions, I'll pop your hand up for Andrew. Just show of hands if people got questions. Okay, we might come back.
Was that persuasive?
I've got a few questions here, Andrew, that have been texted in.
Yep.
On the phone. This one might be a little bit technical, but certainly perhaps showing up some contradictions in the Bible here. The question is, you said that we can't be certain of when human life begins, and you might want to unpack that a bit for us, what you do think about when human life begins. And the question is, what would you say to passages like Jeremiah 1, which gets quoted a lot in the pro-life, pro-choice type debates, which sort of posits that Jeremiah was set apart in his mother's womb to be a prophet, or John the Baptist from the New Testament, who's filled with his spirit in his mother's womb. And the question is, if he or Jeremiah weren't human, how could they be filled with his spirit? So maybe unpacking a bit about when life begins.
There are lots of texts. For those of you who are Christian, you'd probably know many of them. For those of you who aren't, bear with me for a moment. There are lots of texts that Christians use that or many Christians use, that they think proves that life begins at conception. Psalm 139 is a place where people go. Jeremiah 1 is a place where people go. It seems to me that neither of those texts do the work that a lot of Christians would like them to do. I'd very much like to know for sure when human life begins. I'm just not convinced that the Bible tells us this. Psalm 139 does talk about God knowing us, knitting us together in the womb. Psalm 139 also, however, talks about God knowing the words before they're on our tongue. So it seems as though God is able to know something before it exists. So God knowing us and knitting us together in the womb tells us that that is part of the story of whatever it is that makes us up. It doesn't necessarily tell us that my personal being begins then. Similarly, Jeremiah was set apart from the womb, but in fact, he was set apart from before he was conceived. So again, this notion that he was set apart by God doesn't mean that God has to have Jeremiah in personal existence in order to do that kind of stuff, to know or appoint him for a particular task. This is a God whose knowledge seems to be able to go beyond what currently exists, to what hasn't yet come into being. So it seems to me that those texts, while I understand why people take them that way, it just doesn't seem that they do that kind of work. And similarly, John the Baptist, by the time he gets to leap in Mary's womb, I was talking about a fetus at 3 months, there's probably 5 to 6 months, what's often called quickening, I don't know if you know that term. It's the age in a fetus development when a mother is first able to feel discernible movements in her uterus, and that's normally about 5 to 6 months. In the grand scheme of things, particularly if you're talking about issues of abortion, that's terribly, 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 terribly late in the process. That's kind of third trimester abortion or late stage abortions, if you know that language. So it's considerably later than the kind of territory that a lot of people want to talk about. And what he's responding to is the presence of the mother of my Lord. So again, it doesn't quite do the kind of work that some Christians would like it to do. And again, let me be clear, I would like to know, I just don't. So sometime between conception and probably quickening, I guess, but push me, don't know.
We've got a question from the other end of life, which is, what about when someone is only alive because they're on life support? Should it just be kept on indefinitely?
Good question, and that's the kind of question. Oh, well, I mean, I've had to face it both professionally and personally. So it depends. There's your answer. Because what you're talking about, when you're talking about life support, you're talking generally about ventilator support, so a tube down someone's throat and a machine which assists them in breathing, and very often other things like dialysis and various other techniques to try and keep various organ systems which are failing going, or to keep the organism going while those organ systems recover. Now, that kind of stuff is used routinely in surgery. Is it appropriate to turn off that life support when someone's having a surgical procedure? Probably not, I hope. So it depends. There are times when it's fairly clear that this support is needed for a particular crisis period, and it will be fairly clear by the end of that crisis period whether it's working or not, whether they're likely to recover or not. Yep. There are other times when it's not clear, and it may go on for a long time, and it's only after a considerable period of time that it becomes clear that this isn't working, that this person, as far as we can tell, and it's always as far as we can tell, is not going to leave hospital and live a normal human life. Yep. So I'm guessing that it's that kind of question that we're asking. And I think the only way to frame an appropriate answer to that question is to get the question right. And that is, I think the first question is this treatment likely to benefit this person? If the answer is yes, then it's probably worth continuing. Probably. Although you never know for sure. If it's not likely to benefit them, then probably no. Why? See up your hand if you've ever been in an intensive care unit. Not necessarily as a patient, you can be a visitor. Okay, now, you've seen what it's like for someone to be on a ventilator, haven't you? They need to be kept very heavily sedated, because otherwise they try waking up, they try vomiting, coughing, ripping the tube out. Oh, it's really, 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 really unpleasant. The only justification for putting someone through that is because you think it might help them in the long run. Yes? So if the answer is no, then the answer is, why would you continue to subject someone to that if it's not going to do them any lasting good? Yeah? But always, 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 these are tricky, complex, and specific questions. And you need to know the person, know their background, know their wishes, know their future, know their clinical circumstances before you can make any kind of reasonable judgment on that. Sorry, long answer.
Yeah, Matt, a question from the floor.
So you kind of talked about the whole idea of ending life at the beginning and at the end.
Yep.
What is the Christian view about ending life kind of like in the middle, so suicide?
This isn't to garner sympathy or anything like that, just to let you know the context in which I think about these things. A few years ago, my sister committed suicide, so this is something I've lived through, and it sucks. But has anybody had someone they love commit suicide? It's horrible, is it not? For me, it left me feeling angry and dirty and guilty and horrible. It just sucks. So one of the things we need to remember is that that's what suicide does to other people. That's the first thing to remember. So is this a good thing? Don't be a bloody idiot. Of course it's not. The question is, what is it that drives someone to the point where they are willing to end their own existence? And again, there are all sorts of things. It can be a cry for help, often a failed cry, you know, of the thing called parasuicide. Which is an attempted suicide, which is really an attempt to try and get someone to pay attention when they think that nothing else will get them attention. Sometimes that works too well and the person dies. Sometimes it's really a statement of anger. Sometimes it's an expression of despair. In the latter, particularly if this is a result of a deep and intractable psychiatric illness, but I'm not sure that they're in the position where the category sin applies to that particular action. In fact, if you think about it, legally, someone who is in that position is not counted as responsible for their actions, which is why they can be involuntarily admitted to a psychiatric hospital. Is that not right? That's because they're in such a state that they are no longer fully responsible for their actions. I think that's important to remember. But suicide is always horrible, it seems to me. Yeah, I can understand the circumstances which might lead someone to think that this is the only recourse. I can't see that it's ever appropriate. Yeah. Is it?
In terms of sort of following along the same lines of in the middle of life, if someone falls into a coma, I'm not sure as to what the legal thing is within Australia, but where would Christians take
loved one falls into a coma, what do you do with that?
I've...
So, and even if it continues for, say, 30 years, do you just...
Right. Again, this is something I've had both professional and personal experience of, so that colours how I see these things. First thing to do is, this doesn't sound glib, first thing to do is pray. But once you've done that, you need to think hard. And again, that goes back to what I was saying earlier about thinking about the particular circumstances, because there are some comas which you can be, there's a very good chance that this is reversible. Say, after a significant head injury, one of the things that happens is the brain swells up and the neurological system shut down and someone goes into a coma. If you support them through that period, then a few days, maybe a week, maybe a few weeks later, then the system starts to recover. And you never know whether it's going to recover fully or not. You just generally don't know. So it depends on the circumstances. There are a couple of really horrible things that can happen to people. There's a thing called locked-in syndrome. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. It's where people's ability to interface with the world is lost, but their brains still work. Nightmare. That's probably about my worst possible nightmare, quite frankly, because there's no way of them demonstrating that the lights are on. Okay? The lights are on, but all the shutters are down. You've got no idea what's going on. There's also what's called a persistent vegetative state, which looks the same, but there are no lights on. Okay, there are no higher functions at work. Clinically, it's incredibly hard. I really respect neurologists and those who have the difficulty of trying to figure out what's going on. But I think all you can do is make the best judgment that you can as to where this person is and what kind of likelihood of recovery there is. And if you don't think that persisting with this kind of treatment is likely to lead to their recovery, then you change the way that you care for them. It's no longer attempting to get them better. It's doing what you can to show that you love them while they die, however long that takes, and that can take a long time, unfortunately.
We might take a few more questions that have been texted in. Thank you for your questions. Two questions that are quite similar, perhaps quite personal as well. God seems to be really angry when we don't welcome life. Does this mean there is no forgiveness for people who do abortions? And a similar question about whether if you have had an abortion, God would send you to hell. And can I just say, if that's you, and if you want to particularly talk through personal things, then we would really love to help you with that. And Andrew will be around after the talk today, and some other trained staff who'd love to talk that through with you if you'd like to do that too. But yeah, those two questions.
Okay. Let me say up front, I think there's really only one unforgivable sin, and that is in the end saying that what God was doing in Jesus was something that Satan was doing instead. That's it. Anything else is subject to the forgiveness of God and what God has done for us in the person of Jesus. There is no other, as far as I can see, unforgivable sin. Going back to that question of suicide, it's certainly not an unforgivable sin. That's not at all the way that works. My understanding is that God holds us all equally under judgment and the yearning of his grace. That is, all of us, except for what God has done us in Jesus, all of us stand under the judgment of God and the inevitability of that judgment. All of us alike face that. And yes, there's differentiation, there's distinction and so on, but not in the sense of whether we do or do not face the judgment of God. But equally, all of us stand in the presence of the yearning of God's grace, of a God who wants to claim us for his own so much and to enable us to know the riches of life so much that Jesus died to bring us that freedom. Does either performing or having an abortion close you off from the yearning of God's grace? No, not at all, not in any sense whatsoever. And if the church has ever given you the impression that that's the case, then I'm sorry, because sometimes we suck.
A lot of the time. I've got another question here, which bounces off that particular one. Question for you, Andrew. Is it right to impose a Christian ethic upon others who might not be Christian? So perhaps a more of a meta question there, but yeah.
Yep. impose? Not generally. I think it's right for us to engage robustly in conversations about how we construct a good society. What is it that makes for human flourishing? And I think Christians have some particularly helpful things to say about that. But this is, I'm a very strong believer in democratic processes, and it seems to me that the kinds of societies in which we live, the very notion that we can impose our views on anyone is a nonsense. All we can do is be part of an ongoing conversation and invite people to consider what we have to contribute to the shaping of a good society. And that's what I think we can do. People are going to disagree, and that's fine. And we engage in robust conversation. That's democracy, isn't it? But imposition? Probably not. The question then is, what role does the law play in something, let's say euthanasia, for example, where at the moment it is not legal to euthanize, if that's the appropriate verb. I've never known what verb to use, but anyway. It's not legal to euthanize anyone, I don't believe, in any state or territory in Australia. I'm pretty sure that's still the current state of the law. The question is, why should we seek to keep that legal position, as I would seek to keep that legal position? And that's because of, I think, the vision of society that would undergird a change in the law and the way that it would affect the healthcare system. I mean, people have talked about a specialist thanatology unit. That is, a unit where death is the goal. That's very different to what normally happens elsewhere in the healthcare system. And it seems to me that they're the kinds of questions we ought to look at. I don't know if that addresses the question, but not imposition, but invitation to conversation is how I'd think of it.
Great. We're sort of out of time for questions texted in, but any final question from the floor? Great, okay. Well, one last question, yeah?
So the question is, when a bill is introduced to Parliament to, say, legalise euthanasia, how should we respond? Right. So what it does... I've been involved in some of the inquiries on some of this stuff, and what they do is they invite public responses. So the framers of the legislation will open it up for public discussion. Not necessarily these endlessly repetitive think tank things which go nowhere, but actual community engagement on these substantive issues. And our responsibility and privilege, and it's both, is to engage in that conversation, to say, here are the reasons. And I think as a Christian, the lines of argument I would want to pursue are not, here's what the Bible says, because unless the person who's hearing that is also a Christian, yeah, so what? It's, let's think about what this means for our society. Let's think about how this would, in an unwelcome way, refashion how we engage with each other in community. Let's think about what it would do to how we view each other, how we treat vulnerable people and so on, and engage in the conversation at that level. But we have the great privilege and responsibility of being involved in the democratic process, and that's how it works. So do it. It's kind of fun.
Andrew, thanks very much for engaging so thoughtfully and critically with these big questions today. If you have more questions, particularly about these end of life and beginning of life questions. And if you'd like to talk to someone personally, then please do chat to Andrew, who'll be around straight afterwards and around the chat. We'll have some staff as well, just on the table outside. So if you want to chat privately, confidentially to someone, then we'd love to help you with that. Please do take that opportunity. That's the end of our time together today. We'll be having afternoon tea immediately outside and down the stairs. And can I encourage you to pop those slips in the green buckets on the way out? And we'd love to see you tomorrow, 12 o'clock at the New Law Lecture Theatre to talk about sex and freedom. Thanks very much.